What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, an affiliate of Mad in America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at madinamerica.com. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, our guest is Sean Blackwell. Sean was hospitalized in 1996 for acute psychosis and then discovered it was, in fact, a spiritual emergence experience he was going through. Sean's the author of the book, Am I Bipolar or Waking Up? He's the facilitator of breathwork healing retreats for people diagnosed with bipolar disorder and psychosis. So welcome to Madness Radio, Sean Blackwell.
Hi, Will. Thanks for having me.
It's good to see you again. A few months ago, I was down at your retreat in Brazil as part of a conference I was going to, and I had the opportunity to myself experience one of your breathwork healing retreats firsthand. So we're going to be talking about that on the show today. And you have been bringing breathwork, which we're going to be talking about what that is, to people who are wanting to recover and work with healing their experiences. But maybe we could start out with you saying a little bit about how you got involved with this work, and you yourself were hospitalized. You yourself went through a psychotic experience.
1996, I'm on an intensive self-help weekend with the what's called the Landmark Forum, sort of related to this thing from EST training in the 1970s. And it was just a very intense experience. And there was a moment there where they asked us to meditate on our fears and something related to a scuba diving accident I had had just a few months earlier surfaced, and I just popped and all my senses got sharpened. And a few days later, I just came to the assumption that I was kind of dreaming the whole thing and I was on a mission. I wasn't really on a mission. I thought I died during the scuba diving accident and I was going to meet God and I was being tested by God. I was in my underwear in a hotel ballroom and the police came to get me because I refused to put my clothes back on because God wanted me to arrive in heaven or nirvana or wherever in my purest form.
So this was triggered by the kind of emotional stress of the workshop that you were doing. You said it was really intense.
Well, it was kind of a perfect storm of things. There was a lot of triggers around the whole event. I had just changed cities. I was just changing jobs. I had had some trauma come up from the scuba diving accident where I lost my weight belt at about 90 feet below sea level, so I could have died. And then this Landmark Forum event, it was like 150 people all in a fairly small room being challenged about their own egos and how we're causing our own issues and causing our own dramas in our lives, basically pointing the finger at us and saying we're the biggest part of the problem in our own lives.
Strong. They're really pushing you to the breaking point. And you, it sounds like you broke in a really spectacular way. You went into a big altered state that would be called mania or psychosis, that would be seen as a symptom of bipolar disorder and a mental illness, right?
In the first few days, it led to things like me not really sleeping very much and starting to write all kinds of texts. Some of it was just wild stuff, other stuff related to issues in my own family, things like that. But then it just sort of launched off into, oh, I get it. I understand everything now. I must be dead. And once that delusion took hold, then things started to get a little bit.
At the time, it must have been really terrifying, and you ended up You're hospitalized for a few days, yeah?
Yeah, and I would say that I went through an ego death of a sort. And not this sort of, oh, my ego has died and I'm this enlightened being now. Just a kind of an ego collapse that leads to an opening and broadening of your ego.
But really disorganized, like you were acting really weird. You weren't able to kind of do your ordinary responsibilities in the world.
And function.
And you got the attention of the police, because taking your clothes off in the middle of a ballroom and not and refusing to put them back on is gonna alert the psychiatrists and the doctors for sure.
Yeah, and I pissed on the rug there, and I was rolling around in my own urine. It was just like, it was pretty full on.
So you're breaking the social conventions, but when people would say, "Hey, Sean, you're having an altered state. You're really kind of doing something really extreme." You had no self awareness at all. Is that right?
Well, they wouldn't really say that to you, because when you go into that state, everybody around you sort of gets scared and they don't really reach out and communicate with you in a genuine way.
Yeah, that's a big observation you make, because it's not just the individual that goes into this different sort of moment or this different state. It's actually all the people around them too. Often for them, it's the fear and the paralysis and the, oh my God, how do we not make it worse? Or what should we do? Or we're scared of this person. And then it just sort of feeds into itself.
Yeah. And I mean, if someone like you or Michael Cornwall, for example, had been with me and been able to relate to me and got a blanket around me and just gave me some space, I might not have needed to be hospitalized at all. They were nice about it. They actually seemed like they had been trained for this sort of situation. And they said to me, they said, Sean, we don't really want to hurt you, man, but you got to come with us. And then they grabbed me and put me on the carpet. I actually got a carpet burn on my shoulder. They were pretty rough, because I was in pretty good shape at the time. So I was a handful, you know, even for two police officers.
You were kind of resisting. You were saying, no, I don't want to go. I want to.
Yeah. And then they got, because I didn't know, one grabbed one hand, one grabbed the other. They got me on the floor, handcuffed me, and then got me in the hospital in the ambulance. And I still thought I was going to, I'll say heaven for lack of a better word, but I didn't really know what was going on. But I thought I was being transported to another dimension.
Which in the sense you were, because the psychiatric system is definitely a different dimension of reality, you could say.
Well, I think what saved me in a sense was I didn't know what was going on. But after 24 hours of sleep, I was like, I don't know what's going on, but I know I need to get out of here. And so then I just started telling them what I thought they wanted to hear, which was, my name is Sean Blackwell. I'm in Toronto. These are my family members. And I think I'm better now. I told them I thought I had a post-traumatic stress disorder from the scuba diving accident, because I thought that would impress them. If I could diagnose myself, I thought they would be impressed by that. But then I went home and...
So it sounds like the sleep deprivation was a key element to what kind of broke you through to this state.
I'm sure it was part of it. I'm sure it was part of it.
And then getting some sleep brought you down out of it to some degree.
Yeah, I think so.
And then what happened when you went home?
I was pretty vulnerable and I didn't talk to too many people for quite a while. But after a few weeks, an ex-girlfriend's friend of mine she was from India. She was a past life therapist, and she came to visit me. And she was like, Sean, as soon as I heard about what happened to you, I knew what it was. Because for me, I was just talking about spiritual things and peace and love and all this stuff. And she, from her background, she sort of identified with me having a sort of awakening experience. And so in talking to her, it gave me some validation.
So she was familiar with Eastern religion and reincarnation and spirituality and yoga and this kind of thing.
And that helped. That helped provide a context. The first book she gave me was, I think, Autobiography of a Yogi by
Paramahansa Yogananda. And so she really kind of guided you to having a different framework. Were you questioning your sanity before that? Were you saying, oh no, maybe I have a mental disorder? Did they give you medication in the hospital? What were they recommending to you? Or what was their understanding? And then how did you get this different understanding?
Well, I had been studying a little bit about Buddhism previously for a couple of years. And my experience in the non-ordinary state was so overwhelmingly positive. I was a person who always felt like I didn't know enough. Finally, I felt like I had everything that I needed to know. I had insight into my family. All my senses had sharpened. And there was some fear that came up that, ironically, the self-help course had sort of helped me get in touch with. And then I could get in touch with that fear and express it. So it was so overwhelmingly positive that when the psychiatrist started talking to my family about a mental illness, I just thought they were idiots and I blocked it all out. So I didn't go through the process of internalizing the stigma of mental illness the way pretty much 99% of people who get hospitalized do. And I think that was the great blessing of my experience, that I could get out of there relatively unharmed, you know?
Yeah, because my experience was so dark, on the other hand. It was so negative. There was so much suffering and pain and fear around it that I desperately wanted to believe that I had schizophrenia or a mental illness, or, you know, and that the medications were helping me, because I was in so much pain. I was looking for a way out. So that was the solution, but you came at it from a different kind of angle. But were you, even though you didn't see yourself as having a mental illness, were you able to go back to work or kind of return to your sort of ordinary responsibilities in life? Or
I was in a very lucky place because I had actually just moved back to Toronto from Vancouver to apply for a job interview. So I had like my first job interview with this particular company just a day or two before my episode. And then as things turned out, I would just go and work part-time for this guy like for maybe a few days every couple of months. And so I had about 4 months there where I could just stay home and integrate and then just go out once in a while and do a bit of work. And that's exactly what I needed. And I returned to work full time about 5 months later and nobody knew anything. Like I was able to keep it completely under wraps.
You know? So it was kind of a perfect storm that led you into the crisis, but also you had a kind of a positive perfect storm. If you had really good supportive elements in place that helped you make it through it, it sounds like.
Right. And my parents, you know, my parents are 50, like I'm 53. So my parents were like growing up in the 1950s. So they had a healthy distrust of psychiatrists from back then. You know, that generation, they don't trust the shrinks, right? So they didn't have much of an interest in me seeing those doctors unless I wanted to go. So I didn't get any family pressure either. You know, so that was really helpful. They were quite supportive, even though they didn't know what I was going through.
So you went back to your work, to your career. It's interesting. You and I both have sounds like you were a lot more extensively involved in advertising in that world. But I did actually spend about 6 months in Portland working for Wieden and Kennedy, a big advertising agency there. So we have that. It's one of many things that we have in common, actually. And then what happened? So you continued to work in your life, and then how did that go?
Well, I actually got into a job in advertising after my crisis that I've been trying to get into for 4 years, finally landed that sort of big job opportunity that I've been looking for. And then even though I was looking for a way out, I became really successful in the job in a way that I'd never been before. My salary tripled over the next 3 years.
Do you think that the success in the job was maybe it was contributed to by these positive things that had happened to you after this crisis break that you had?
Yeah, absolutely. Because before that, I was sort of guarded. I didn't connect with people particularly well. And I was always worrying about how I was going to get my job done. And I didn't realize I was like that, but I was like that. And then when I had my crisis and I went back, I was much more easy. It was much easier for me to connect with people. And people felt that I really cared about their business. And things went really well. Even though I really wasn't into advertising anymore, things went much more smoothly and I was much more successful. And it was directly related to this, what I came to call a spiritual emergency, which was Stan Grof's term.
So this thing that happened to you, this crisis or this break, which would have been seen as an illness and impairment and a limitation, actually helped your life.
It was the most important thing that has ever happened to me personally, in my opinion.
And so you mentioned Stan Grof, and maybe we should say who that is because he's an important part of your story and also the whole question of can these so-called bipolar and psychotic states, can they actually be spiritual awakening experiences? So maybe tell us about how you learned about his work and what you've got from it.
Well, after I got back to work, I realized that I didn't really want to be in advertising. And I started to go into personal development work and different therapies. And I was going to see a Rolf masseuse, which is like a deep body tissue masseuse, told her what happened to me. And she said, well, you should know about the work of this guy, Stan Grof. And so I picked up his books. And it turned out he's one of the founders of transpersonal psychology. He was the last psychiatrist who was legally allowed to use LSD with his patients in the 1960s. And he had developed a technique called holotropic breathwork for helping people with a wide variety of issues, but mainly for personal development, to go into non-ordinary states for healing purposes. Because he recognized that many, or I don't want to say many, but there are non-ordinary states you can go into that can be very healing, and that was not recognized in modern medicine or psychiatry or psychology. He coined the term holotropic. It tends to be something mostly in your neck of the woods over there in the Pacific Northwest, it's sort of stronger there, but in the rest of the US it's not so strong. And just to give people a bit of an explanation, transpersonal comes from the idea that you're going beyond the personal ego. You know, so transpersonal ego is really, it should be transpersonal ego psychology. And that going beyond the ego can happen in two ways. You can go beyond the ego, going into a non-binary state through things like breath work or shamanic dancing or taking psychedelics, for example. Those are three ways you could do it. But there's also another way of sort of going beyond the rational ego, which is in your own personal development, where you start to become a more intuitive person. So there's sort of two directions that this transpersonal vision can go.
Because traditionally, psychology has just been dismissive of religion and spirituality. Well, it's not scientifically based. It's just, you know, paranormal, and it's, you know, it's not material. It's not evidence. It's not actually, you can't actually look at it, you know, concretely. And so it's been dismissive of it. But actually, there has been this trend in psychology that goes back to William James and many people in the psychological tradition, Jung, and that says, well, actually, we do need to take these experiences seriously, that what gets called paranormal and parapsychological or mystical is part of human culture and tradition and history for since the beginning of human civilization. So let's take it seriously. And my understanding is that Groff, after LSD research was made illegal, he developed a parallel way of exploring and entering into and accessing altered states of consciousness that are similar to psychedelic states through breath work. And this is what I did when I was down in Brazil with you at your healing retreat, and have had a number of experiences with personally over the years. But maybe we should say a little bit more about what breath work is, because this is your main work at this point.
Well, I guess we're starting with this term breath work. You know, what Stan Groff created is sort of a trademarked format, which he calls holotropic breathwork, which usually involves a group setting, which can be a group of anywhere between 2 and 200 people. I mean, it can be a really big group if you've got enough facilitators in place.
Actually, yeah, I did breathwork in Germany, and there were about 150 people in the room at a yoga conference. So, and I would definitely not recommend that to people who are not familiar with this territory or haven't done a lot of preparation work. This is not something you want to just dive into. And so harm reduction and adequate preparation is really key. It's not something you want to just start experimenting with on your own, for example. Although relatively speaking, compared to psychiatric medications, the side effects and risk profile is extremely low for breath work.
And the idea, I guess, is that we have this bioenergetic system similar to our chakra system or kundalini system, subtle body, whatever name you want to put there, and that system is carrying blockages in it, and that those blockages are related to, for lack of a better word, our traumas in life, difficulties, maybe karmic issues even, past life issues, birth process problems too, birth trauma. All of this is in our sort of bioenergetic system. And so by putting people in a safe set and setting, that's very important, that you've got a trained facilitator with you in a protected space where you're on a yoga mat, and then we're playing some, you know, designed music to sort of, that's very emotionally evocative, and it's bringing emotions forward. You put people in that setting and you get them to breathe more aggressively, and they'll go into a non-ordinary state. Most people will go into a non-ordinary, what I would say, holotropic state within about 20 minutes.
So for some context here, this is not something new. Actually, this is the basis of healing throughout human history, that there have been ceremonies where people go into these energized, altered states of consciousness, sometimes through dancing, through music, through psychedelic drugs, through the incantations and the prayers of the shaman or the medicine person. And then that context and the state generate an opening of some kind into something beyond the person that allows some kind of healing process to take place. So really it's kind of a new version of a very ancient form of healing. And you could say, well, wait a second, where's the evidence here? Isn't this just placebo effect? And the answer might be, maybe it's an effective use of the placebo effect. You generate a very strong kind of group field or intentional context, a container, a set and setting, and then you mobilize the human innate capacity to heal and change and transform and access different parts of ourselves just through the power of mind and the power of belief. Because the setting that you described, the group, the intense evocative music, the breathing and the physiological changes that the breathing makes are very, very powerful for shifting you out of your ordinary understanding of yourself and going into something that might give you access to some kind of healing capacity. And the placebo effect is being studied throughout medicine because it is real and it's extremely significant. And a lot of doctors are now realizing that instead of kind of excluding it from our data because it's not real or it's not evidence-based, it actually is a kind of evidence that people have the capacity to have this placebo response. And so there's a lot of mystery as to how breath work actually works, but it certainly is consistent with what we know about human history and about the capacity of the mind for healing.
Yeah, absolutely. And what Groff would say, and what I agree with, is that the healing agent itself, what exactly is doing the healing, is a inner healer, he would call it. And that's the most radical part of this whole thing, is that what he's saying is that there's a deeper intelligence that goes beyond our own minds that can come in and take control of our psyche and reorganize it. You know, Artie Lang in the 1960s, he was like, acute psychosis is intended to be a reorganization of the psyche. Well, what is doing the reorganization if we've lost our minds and we're really sort of out of control? It's this higher intelligence, you know. Groff calls it the inner healer. I see it more as a field, but that's really the healing agent. And at that point, spirit or God, or I guess spirit is maybe a better word right now, stops being a religious belief and starts being more of a scientific assumption. It's like, we can't prove that the spirit is there. It could be aliens, could be angels, could be something else. But there's definitely this higher intelligence that takes place. And you see that through repeated observation with, you know, with people. I mean, probably over 100,000 people have done a holotropic breathwork session at this point.
And there's a big overlap with psychedelics, because for a long time, the psychedelic healing world was pushed underground by the war on drugs and the prohibition. And now, of course, what we're seeing is a resurgence of psychedelic medicine, unfortunately, in the context of the pharmaceutical industry and promoting it as treatments to mental disorders, and the whole DSM framework comes in. But what we're seeing is that the mainstream medicine is really recognizing that, that what we're talking about does have some substance to it from that perspective. And breath work does a lot of the kinds of things that taking psychedelics do, but without a chemical, without a substance, without the often very extreme experiences that psychedelic drugs can bring. And it's actually a lot safer. There aren't as many of the risks as we find with psychedelics, which are often not being recognized these days, but psychedelics can be quite risky and unpredictable. And so breathwork in one way represents a pathway parallel to psychedelic drugs, but without some of the risks. Of course, it doesn't have as much of the attractiveness to psychiatry and to pharmaceutical industry, because you can't quite package it and sell it like you can a substance, but it does have a lot of the same potential and possibility. Do you want to just say a little bit more about what actually a breathwork session involves? You mentioned the music and the group, but let's paint more of a picture for people of what actually it looks like.
There'll be a group of people in a room. We'll say we'll talk about 12 people for the sake of argument, okay? Six of those people will be the breathers, and then six of those people will be sitters. They will sit and support the breather empathetically. So people will be sort of taken into pairs, okay? And then you'll have these facilitators who are trained professionals through a Groff transpersonal training, who have learned how to relate to people when the holotropic experiences become more powerful or extreme, you might say. So you'll have six people laying down. Lights will be dimmed. People will put masks on. They'll lay on yoga mats. They'll start a kind of a relaxation exercise to relax their entire body. And they'll be encouraged to start breathing more aggressively. You know, nothing really planned. You can breathe in your own way. the way I would breathe might sound more like almost like a jogging or an exercise breath, but comfortable. And then the music that's played, especially in the first hour, tends to be quite aggressive. A lot of hard tribal drumming, some electronic music, things to get you really activated and energized. And I would describe it as more of an aggressive masculine energy to sort of take you into that territory.
And so if anybody's gone to a big concert where there's lots of dancing and it's really intense and really loud music, you can kind of feel a sense of that. You start to lose yourself. You sort of go into this altered state, mild, just from being in this intense sensory overload kind of environment. So when we talk about, you know, going beyond the ego or going into the altered state, it sounds like this sort of weird, rarefied thing. But actually, we're kind of already familiar with going into altered states because it happens to us when we listen to music, or if we go into a trance when we're driving, or certainly when we drink alcohol or smoke cannabis, or we're dancing for a long period of time, or maybe we're hiking, or we have sleep deprivation. So in breath work, we're working with a similar kind of capacity, the innate capacity that the psyche of all humans has to go into these altered states, which are stepping outside of your ordinary identity and stepping outside of your ordinary sense of yourself. And in the breath work, it's very concentrated, focused, and harnessed for a very specific purpose.
Yeah. And, you know, I used to belong to a shamanic group, and we would do these shamanic dances where we would go like for 3 days with no food and no water, you know. And I was talking to my shaman friend that used to lead these dances. And I told her, I'd say, you know how we'd be doing all this dancing, and then we'd sort of hit the pole and go into a non-ordinary state, be carried back to our birth. And she'd say, yeah. I'd say, well, when you do holotropic breath work, you get there in about 5 minutes. And she cracked up laughing, because in the shamanic dances, you're just sort of suffering and you're starving and you're sweaty and you're hot and you're exhausted. And then, boom, you get transported into this, you know, non-ordinary state. And then with breath work, it's like, well, you're there in about 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's extraordinarily powerful. And, you know, you mentioned before the idea of set and setting. And we know from research, going back to what I said about the placebo effect, just the expectation of healing is itself very powerful. So in the world of psychedelic medicine, even the people who are doing the laboratory research about psychedelic to develop new psychedelic pharmaceuticals, they recognize the central importance of set and setting. And until you've actually been through it, you're of course quite skeptical, because all you're doing is lying there and breathing in a really intense way, listening to really powerful music. And you might think, well, you know, nothing's going to happen. What can happen? Well, actually, a lot happens. And one of the things that I think is powerful about breath work is that even though you are going in this journey where you give up control because you go into this altered state, you have much more control, in the sense that you can open your eyes, take the mask off, and you could turn the music off, and you could kind of interrupt it. And that creates a certain degree of safety that psychedelic drugs don't have, or going off into the wilderness for 3 days for a really intense vision quest doesn't have. And people are very skeptical. They say, well, you know, psychedelics, ayahuasca, I mean, yeah, that's causing this chemical thing in my brain, but how could just breathing do something as powerful? And the answer is yes, it can do something as powerful.
Well, I think the big mistake people make with psychedelics is that they think that the healing agent is in the chemical itself. And I don't believe it is. I think that the chemical agent is causing a breakdown of the ego, particularly with the psychedelics. It's causing a breakdown of the ego by chemical means, which is opening you up to the inner healer. Like when people have healing experiences on ayahuasca, it's still this divine intelligence that's working through you. It's not necessarily the plant.
I would tend to agree with that. I would just add that, especially with ayahuasca, there's a continuity with the indigenous traditions, because in an ayahuasca ceremony, there's often people who have been to the Amazon and who are bringing those songs forward, and they have that connection, and there's an evocation and a continuity with an existing indigenous tradition that maybe magnifies and amplifies this inner capacity that I think that you're pointing to, and I think correctly, that we all have. And of course, all these things are extremely mysterious, but we should say, to kind of pick up where you were talking about the description of painting a picture for people, that, you know, you start breathing and the music is loud, and then tell us what happens to people at that point.
Well, the breathing is a little bit like, imagine you're a surfer and you want to go surf waves. Well, before you're surfing, you have to swim out to meet those waves. So the breathing is like swimming out into the ocean of your unconscious. And then these waves of unconscious material will start to surface. And when they come, you don't need to really worry about the breathing. What's more important is your own self-expression, which is through the physical movement and the vocalizing. You're going to be moving around on the mat to sort of express what's happening in your psyche.
In a sense, it's a form of very deep listening. You're going into a very, very deep listening to parts of yourself that you maybe haven't listened to because you haven't had the space or the opportunity or the invitation to do that.
What you're describing as the unconscious is what most people think of the unconscious, but it does get freakier. So like this weekend, there was a guy there and he turned into a gorilla. And so he was on the mat making like sort of intimidating gestures with his teeth, making gorilla noises, sort of moving around the mat like a gorilla. And so we needed to sort of keep him in a protected space because as long as he's on his yoga mat acting like a gorilla, that's fine. But if he starts to run around the room and jump on other breathers like a gorilla, that's a real problem. So that's why you need these trained facilitators there.
So when you say unconscious material, there's something going on there. He's not just acting freaky, but there may be a part of himself that needs to be in touch with the strength or the primal spontaneity or the rawness or the animal quality. Or maybe the gorilla is a symbol that he's picked up, that he has some meaning, he has some meaningful association with it. And then by playing it out in this theatrical expression, he's moving something in his deeper psyche that maybe was stuck,
yeah,
as you were saying before. And then it somehow, because I think that from the outside, what we're describing is so experiential. It's like trying to describe someone what going to a concert is if they've never heard music. I mean, you don't really understand it unless you've kind of been through it. So he turns into a gorilla in a sense. He acts like a gorilla. How is that helpful for him, or was it helpful for him? Why might that be helpful for someone to do this freaky, weird thing?
Oh, well, I think it can be very helpful for a person because it's exactly how you just described it, Will. You know, you can think of it in the simplest terms as an archetypal kind of energy that has been repressed in you. It's not really part of your daily psyche. It's a repressed part of your unconscious, and now it's coming into you. So now you have more of an authentic, positive, masculine presence. Whereas maybe in the past, for example, that gorilla energy, assuming that it was a masculine force, if that masculine force is repressed and isn't part of your daily psyche, it might come out in negative ways. It might cause you drama. Maybe it leads you to lash out in violence some ways that you're not, that you really shouldn't be, or even be passive aggressive in ways that are causing difficulties in your life. You know, so once that's integrated, it becomes positive and natural.
So it's a way of getting in touch with ourselves and being more who we are fully. And it goes back to what you had said about the positive benefits of your own breakdown breakthrough were that you go to this workshop, this human potential workshop, you have a lot of stress and you're pushed to the limit and you break through. And now you're acting in this very expressive, wild way. You're peeing on the floor. You've got your clothes taken off. And then after you go to the hospital, you get some sleep, you find that your work life is actually improved because something spontaneous and expressive is now part of your personality. It's been kind of integrated. You said that before that experience, you were a little bit more hesitant, a little bit more shy. You weren't quite as outspoken,
yeah,
a lot more. So you go from being this shy person that has expressiveness in potential to being someone who's actually realizing their own potential of more expressiveness, and then your whole life kind of shifts and lights up. And that's why we're saying that getting in touch with this unconscious, buried experiences and material can actually be beneficial for someone's life. It's a different kind of framework than a lot of psychology sees, because it's all about functioning at the level that you start with. This is more about achieving the potential that you have within you. And I think that Carl Jung's work is very important here, because that's fundamentally how he saw the unconscious and how he saw nature and how he saw the deep psyche, was that it's really a very positive force that's moving us towards realization of what we can be, that nature is always about complexification and expression and individuality. And so to make us more authentically who we are, we have these prompts or these pushes that come from our deeper psyche, but they're actually trying to get us in a positive direction. And that's sort of what happened to you with your crisis, is that this big dramatic break happens, but it's actually something deeper in your unconscious that says, hey, Sean, time to be more expressive, time to be more of an outgoing person. It breaks through, you integrate it, you bring it into your ordinary daily life, you become a different person, and then it gives you all this benefit and changes your life in this positive way. Now, the other side of it, of course, and this is something that's not spoken about in the context of psychedelic medicine and psychedelic experience, and Michael Pollan's new book, I think it's called How to Change Your Mind. Sounds a little bit like a pharma advertisement, actually, and the cover looks a little bit like a pharma advertisement. But Michael Pollan's book also makes this mistake of not seeing the shadow side or the dark side. Because if you go in to a part of yourself and it overwhelms you, and it's too much, and it's too big, and it's too fast, and it's not ready to be brought in, then maybe what you do is, instead of integrating it and bringing it into contact with the rest of you and tempering it and somehow balancing with it, you just cut off your old self. You just push that part of you away. And we know in the work that's done around trauma that overwhelming emotional experiences often fragment the psyche. You can come out of an overwhelming emotional experience being shattered into pieces, and the pieces get buried. And so you could have a psychedelic experience or a breathwork experience and then tell yourself, wow, you know, I've seen the truth. I'm awakened. I'm enlightened now. And I'm just this peaceful, loving, Christ-like figure. And actually, you're not. There's a lot more going on. But because you've held on to it too quickly, it's been too shattering, it's been too overwhelming for you, you've pushed down the parts of you that don't fit that new self-image. And instead of doing the complicated and challenging and humbling integration work, you just go into denial. Psychedelics, breathwork, all of these cathartic, expressive, potentially overwhelming emotional experiences associated with the human growth, human potential movement can be very dissociative and very denial creating. I think we all know people, we've all met people, or maybe we've experienced this in ourselves, where we just get turned on or we get excited about something, or we decide that we've had some kind of breakthrough, but we're not. We're just sort of running away from ourselves. And that, I think, is one of the big dangers. So this is not a formula. There's no recipe here. What it does is it presents you with something very powerful that can be worked with. And in that work, if you're sensitive to the traumatizing, denial, dissociative aspect of it, and you work with facilitators, you work with a community, you work with people close to you, and you explore it in a careful and cautious way with accountability, with feedback from the other, then it can be useful and powerful. But without that awareness of the denial creating dissociative fragmenting potential of psychedelics or breathwork or whatever it is, then yeah, you're stepping into some dangerous territory in terms of abrupt personality change. And it's not a coincidence that, for example, religious cults, and unfortunately some of the psychedelic communities, can start to have some of the qualities of religious cults, and some of the therapeutic communities and therapy schools can have this cult-like quality. And it's because they're pushing people to a breaking point, and then they cut off from the other parts of themselves. They dissociate and go into denial about the other parts of themselves. For example, the part of themselves that might question the authority or the dogma or the leadership or the therapist or the facilitator or the teacher or whoever it is, that part is just pushed away. And then you get into a situation where you have a potential for mind control and groupthink and group conformity around these really strong dissociative experiences. And so I have seen and met wonderful breathwork facilitators and teachers and therapists who use breathwork as well as psychedelics, but I've also met some that I would be very, very cautious about, because it seems like they're in sort of an inflated bubble, that they've reach some realization, but at the expense of going into denial about their own shadows. And I think that deserves a much longer conversation, but that is one of the challenges around psychedelics and breathwork that's not often discussed enough, especially not in the current pharma push to see psychedelics as healing of trauma, rather than taking a look at, well, actually, overwhelming psychedelic experiences can themselves be traumatizing and produce dissociation and denial and fragmentation.
Yeah, and just to tie in this experience of the guy who became the gorilla on the weekend, when I was in the hospital, I went into a kind of spontaneous regression. And at one point, I felt like I was at the beginning of time, and I started making ape noises in the psychiatric hospital. So imagine I'm in my underwear, I'm covered in pee, I'm chained to a hospital bed, and I'm starting to like, you know, here comes the medication, right? I mean, yeah, they don't need to interview you after you make ape noises. But that's exactly what this guy was doing on the weekend. And we've just got this nice little therapeutic container for him. And beautiful. He can just go wild for 3 hours.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if psychiatric hospitals were actually places to express ourselves and to be listened to and held safely, rather than as soon as you get loud or weird, you get contained and suppressed with medication and seen as more of a symptom. Obviously you're delusional, but actually it could be a positive healing process that you're going through, getting in touch with this deeper part of your emotional self. Breathwork is kind of a controlled, safe way of going crazy.
Yeah, I think so.
And this was part of the genius of Lange's work, was that he was trying to create spaces for people to go crazy with Kingsley Hall. And you could say in society, we sort of need people to go a little bit more crazy, because especially with the climate emergency that we're facing and so many social challenges, I think that could be really beneficial. Going a little bit crazy, but doing it in a more controlled, healing, safe way.
That's sort of what I see as my life mission. It's like somehow I've got to get this work into psychiatric hospitals eventually.
Well, there is some interesting research about this, because there are some people who've done this in the past. And of course, we know from the history of psychedelic research that psychedelics, prior to being made illegal, were being brought into supporting and helping people with manic depressive illness and psychosis and schizophrenia, and to help them get in touch with these parts of themselves, with some success, and mixed and complicated. And we can talk about that.
You know what I'd say the big difference is between Groff's work and Lauren Mosher and Artie Lang, is that when you went into psychosis with Artie Lang or Lauren Mosher, they just let you do whatever you want. If you thought UFOs were landing in the park, they would take you out to the park to wait for the UFOs. You know, I've read about these stories in the books, right? With the Groff work, it's like, everything that you're going through can happen on this mat. If you think it's out there, it's not. It's in here. Verticalize your experience and stay with the experience and stay with it here. And that's what makes it safe. That's what makes it safe.
Sean, give us some more examples from your own experience with holotropic breathworks. What are some of the things that you've been through, and how has it been helpful for you?
Okay, well, I've had a number of sessions, and a lot of them included animal experiences. You know, I've been a dog, I've been a salamander, or, you know, these kind of things. But one aspect that's really unique to Groff's work, which is very important, is birth regressions. According to Groff, we tend to invite certain situations in our lives that cause us tension because we're trying to resolve particular traumas that actually started in our birth process, okay? So for example, if you feel like you're constantly in situations or relationships where you're trapped, it's probably because you were traumatized in a phase of the birth process where as a fetus, you were so big that you felt trapped in the uterus, okay? If you felt like your life was controlled, always being controlled by other people, it's very common that people feel that way if they were a cesarean baby, because the cesarean baby is denied the struggle out the birth canal. And with that struggle out the birth canal, people gain their own sense of independence. Okay. In my case, I had been dealing with an issue where I never felt successful. Didn't matter. I worked for 7 different ad agencies in 9 years. The feeling of success never came. I worked as an English teacher for many years, and while I enjoyed it, that feeling never came. And even doing this work, working with people with bipolar disorder, I always felt like I was getting a base hit, but maybe not a home run, for those of you who know baseball. It was like partial successes, but never really deep success. And then in December, I kind of felt something was coming in me. I was in my own personal kind of crisis for a few months there, 2018, 2019. And I called up friends of mine that are Groff facilitators, Antonio, Pedro, and Karen. And I work with people with Antonio, Pedro, and Karen here in Brazil. And I called them up. And I said, look, I think I'm going into a birth regression. And that's an important phase to go through, because if you actually are in a biological regression, you need someone who's been trained to hold you to imitate a uterus so that you can actually struggle through that birth canal.
If you look at it just from the outside, what is Sean talking about? But actually, what we're talking about is the experiences that people have, and then they report that this is really beneficial. And this is the framework for understanding it, that actually not to necessarily be selling a belief about all this, but more like an invitation that people are actually discovering that this is actually beneficial and helpful for them. And this is one way of looking at it. And so,
I worked with them for a couple of sessions. And then in the third session that I was with them, my whole birth process started. And there was this amazing enthusiasm I had for coming out that birth canal. I felt like I was really ready to face life. But then as I was born, according to the Groff work, there should be a sense with a healthy birth, a sense of victory, a sense of earning something, an accomplishment, and maybe confusion, because you're sort of out into the world for the first time. But in my case, the first words out of my mouth at my birth was, it was like I didn't even have a mother. And I started crying. And it was a very sad moment for me, because it seems like I was one of those 1960s babies that just got wrapped up and taken to a nursery with very little human contact, especially with my mother, you know. And so all of a sudden, the lights went on, that this lack of success I had felt in my life was actually rooted in my birth process.
And then when the lights went on, did you notice that you felt more successful after that? I mean, did it actually create a change emotionally, psychologically for you after that?
Absolutely. And actually it came in another session where I had the sense of taking my arms off, because they represented, two women in my life, my wife and my partner, my co-partner in this work in Germany. And I took them away and I just sat there alone. And then I saw a light above me, a pink light, and I reached up for that light and I pulled it down into me, sitting just in my underwear in the breathwork facility. I was alone in the breathwork facility and they let me take my clothes off, pulled that light into my heart, and then really felt this sense of success. Well, I'm kind of emotional when I think about it, because it was a feeling of success that I never had before, and it came to me in the breathwork process. And then after that, things felt much easier. I've been much more at ease with my life. I'm not nearly as feeling like I'm not doing enough, which is what I felt before. And I'm taking life much more like as it comes and enjoying life more.
So maybe we should talk about my experience with breath work with you in Brazil.
For all of what we've talked about holotropic breath work and how great it is, for the most part, it's not recommended for people who've been diagnosed with disorders. And the reason isn't to sort of pathologize you or pathologize somebody with a disorder, but it's that if deeper traumas arise, that a group setting or a limited time frame is not ideal, because when trauma comes up, it may need to be supported for hours, So trained facilitators are sort of the disorders are contraindicated. So when I found that out, I was like, well, what happens if we create a retreat format for people? I eventually developed a model where people could do talk therapy with me, meditation, mandala drawing, and breath work in a retreat. And my first retreat was in Romania. And her first retreat, she had been hospitalized 10 times. So our first retreat was 3 weeks, just me and her for 3 weeks straight, just to see what happened. And what we found out was that everything else was really secondary, but we could do this breath work a lot, and that it helped people in a very powerful way in a short period of time.
So the approach that Stanislav Grof and holotropic breathwork have taken up till now with your work are that, look, there's this wall, and the people who have psychosis or the people who have mania or they have a bipolar diagnosis or they have a schizophrenia diagnosis, they need to stay away from breathwork. And it's not simply a kind of stigma, although I think the stigma is related here. The intention is protective. The intention is safety. The idea is that, if you have a lot of trauma, if you have a very intense background, if you have a history of going into altered states that are very wild and out of control and get diagnosed and send you into the hospital, we don't want to give you this intense breathwork experience that's just going to trigger that and just going to evoke it. And then suddenly the facilitators there, they don't have the time, they don't have the training, they don't have the resources, they don't have the real capacity to hold and support and care for you in the way that you're needing. And what you've done is you said, okay, well, let me create that actual support. Let me create that time. Let me create that context. And I think that's part of it, but there's also something more to the story, which is that, you know, given the larger context of stigma and given the way in which this wall is created between us and them, you often have in the transpersonal world, you have sort of a judgment of some people who have a psychotic experience that it's not really spiritual emergence. It's not really qualified as something that's a shamanic initiation. It's not really something positive. You really are psychotic. You really are schizophrenic. You really are just one of those bipolar people. And we need to kind of keep you away because this is for this group and this other group needs to not be part of it. And so what myself and other people who have been doing this work, and you've been doing it in a parallel track, we've been saying, wait a second, we need to rethink this wall between the normals and the crazies. And yes, okay, we do need to create safety. We do need to create an appropriate container. We do actually have to have some protections for people in place, but just using it based on your diagnosis to say that once you've been labeled with this, then no, this treatment is not available to you is as misguided as the meditation retreats that say, no, 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 you can't come to our 10-day retreat or you can't come to our meditation training because you have a history of schizophrenia and a history of diagnosis. And this is just another form of exclusion and stigma, but it's complicated because, yeah, it may be that there are people who are going to have more vulnerabilities, they're going to have more specific needs. But my position would be that, look, it's unpredictable. You can exclude people from your meditation retreat, but some people are going to have an extreme experience. Just like, you know, you went to your human potential seminar, the landmark, and if you had told them, yeah, I have a history of bipolar, you know, they wouldn't have let you into the seminar, but of course they don't. It's unpredictable. So instead, what we need to do is to have a much more expansive, open attitude towards all of these experiences. So we're not excluding people arbitrarily. We're meeting people where they're at based on their own needs. And we're also allowing for the fact that, look, even if we do have a filter in place, if we don't let anybody with a diagnosis in, we're still going to run into some people who are going to have maybe difficulty because everybody has this potential within them. So one of the goals that I've had, and some of my colleagues, Dina Tyler and Nita Gage, and the people associated with the Esalen R.D. Lang seminar have been to break down this wall and have a conversation and say, look, breathwork, psychedelic medicine, definitely there's dangers involved, but they are something that we need to look at much more critically in a much more of a nuanced, sophisticated way, rather than just saying someone with a history shouldn't be involved, someone with a history of psychosis, someone with a background. And so that's what you've done. You are someone who has benefited from breath work, even though some breath workers, facilitators trained by Groff would say, no, I'm not going to let you into my workshop because you have this history. You benefited from it. You had a very positive experience in your crisis itself, which I think is part of the story here. And then you've gone on to create an opportunity, not just for the ordinary, the usual person who's invited to do breath work, but for a very specific group of people, which are people who are diagnosed with bipolar, who do have history, and you've created a space that's maybe a little bit more focused, it's more contained, it's more safe, it's more involved, it's more long-term. Because the way that breathwork is done, that holotropic breathwork is done kind of out in the world, it's a bit of an assembly line. It's a bit of a cookie cutter kind of process where large numbers of people are going through these very large group settings and there's not a lot of integration, there's not a sharing circle, there's not follow-up, which I think everybody needs. I don't think it's just for those who are maybe bringing that diagnosis history with them.
Yeah, there was this sort of, well, there's mental illness over here and there's spirituality and spiritual emergency over here. And I think it was quite divisive, okay? And so I think that when the Mad Pride movement would look at transpersonal psychology and say, well, there's sort of this us and them, or the spiritual ones, you're mentally ill, I think there was a fair amount of accuracy to that assessment. Okay, so I don't think you're entirely off base. But within the Groff world, they have been very supportive of what I'm doing. You know, my trainer has been very supportive and admiring of it. And they've even referred people with bipolar disorder to me. So anybody who's innovating with breath work is asked to use a different name. And yeah, I find it a little bit restrictive, but with the amount of innovation I've done, I don't even think what I'm doing is really holotropic breathwork anymore.
And so you create a stronger container in a sense. You provide a much more support and much more safety and protection. Are there people that you wouldn't work with in your breathwork sessions? Maybe that can help us understand where the concern comes in, not from a diagnostic wall, us and them criteria, but more just from a, hey, who's ready for this, or who could benefit from this, or who could do this actually in a safe way?
Right. And you know, most people who've had a disorder, most of them are having financial difficulties, because a lot of the times people can't hold a job. They have to live with their parents. You know, this is a very common scenario. In the beginning, I was like, well, who should I work with and who shouldn't I work with? But later it became more of a question of, is this going to be a good investment for this person? To start, the person that I shouldn't work with is when my work is being recommended by somebody else, like a parent or a family member, and the person who wants to do the work or who needs the work is really in total denial that anything is happening with them at all. That, like, for example, and I know it's not really bipolar disorder. It's not a mental illness per se. It's this bioenergetic disturbance. But if people are just like, there's nothing wrong with me. I don't have bipolar disorder. I don't have anything wrong with me at all. I am perfectly fine and don't want to work on their issues. That's not a person I should be working with, because it's not a case of giving someone a pill and making their problems go away.
And I see this as a therapist as well. I have parents that contact me who want their son or daughter to be on board with the recovery movement, or with coming off medications, or with seeing psychosis in a different way. And I say, look, I got to talk to the person themselves. It's not about forcing someone into a treatment or imposing a pill on them. They also have to be involved. They are involved. They're the center. I'm not sure I would use the word denial, because it could be that the people around them are focusing on the problem that the person has inside of the person. But in saying, I don't have a problem, the person may be focused on something else that actually is also a problem, maybe even a bigger problem. So there's more of a conflict of worldviews. That's how I would look at it. I wouldn't necessarily consider it to be an individual's problem of denial. It's that their experience is just radically different than the people around them in terms of what the cause of the situation is and what the pathway forward. Often what I see with families is that when a young person is in so-called denial, lo and behold, there actually are problems going on with the parents, or there's other problems that are going on that aren't being addressed.
Oh, for sure. And a lot of the times when people, you know, are having these problems, they're embodying the problems in the family. There's no doubt about that.
So we're talking about the kind of people that you don't work, or where your kind of inclusion criteria are for this.
Ideally, you know, the people I think who could really benefit from my work are people who see a strong spiritual dimension to their work, to their experience, and seem determined to really want to go into their own healing process, you know?
So they're on board with your worldview, which I think is really an important part of healing. In fact, there's a lot of research about why psychotherapy works, and it is that relationship, that partnership around a certain kind of optimism that, hey, we have an understanding, we're moving forward here. And so that's what you're describing is consistent with why anyone would be achieving results and success in any kind of healing modality.
And if people are dealing with what I consider more difficult symptoms, particularly paranoia, which has a lot of trust problems, because in breathwork, you need to trust the person you're working with. And in paranoia, you don't trust, you know, very few people, if anybody. We go at it slower. You know, maybe we find a way to do some online counseling first, find a way, you know, maybe shorter sessions, or just take our time with things. And then it becomes more expensive. So is this person prepared to make the investment in their healing? They'll probably need multiple retreats.
So one of the things that we talk about a lot is how the relationship is really central. And it sounds like that's exactly where you're coming from. The relationship that you have with the person and their relationship with their own inner healer and the process is really key to whether it's going to be successful or not.
I think so. And in my own side too, you know, where I've had troubles is when I want to retreat with somebody and I recognize that I'm not just dealing with an issue of the disorder, the so-called disorder, but I've had some people that I don't really like. Okay.
And it's a sure bet they can probably feel that.
Yeah.
On some level.
And if there's a character issue there where I just find that, you know what, this guy is a jerk, it's harder to get the work done that way. Okay. It's a lot easier if we have a positive relationship, you know. It's a long retreat when we don't get along. Let me put it that way.
So much to talk about, brother. I am noticing the time. We're going to need to start to wrap up. So remind us the name of your book and your YouTube channel, how people can get in touch with you.
Okay. The best way to get in touch with me is through my website, bipolarawakenings.com. And there you can access my book. You've got access to my videos as well as information on the healing retreat.
Of course, a lot of people may be interested in breathwork. They can get in touch with you. There are breathwork communities worldwide. That's holotropic breathwork, also different approaches like shamanic breathwork. I'm thinking of the work of Nita Gage, for example, also Linda Starwolf. And I would very strongly recommend that you be very cautious. Don't just find somebody on the internet. Go through friendship networks and get personal referrals so you can find somebody who has integrity, who has a personal recommendation. Ask lots of questions, be very cautious, and also keep in mind that some of the people in that community do have a professional stance and may have a pathologizing approach, and do what you can from a harm reduction perspective. Money is, of course, also a concern, and any practitioner that has integrity will have sliding scale and scholarship opportunities in their work. Sean Blackwell, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you, Will. And I really appreciate your transparency and sharing everything that went on between us. It was a very memorable time we had together.
Well, we'll see how much I edit out, Sean.
Okay, thanks.
You've been listening to an interview with Sean Blackwell. Sean was hospitalized in 1996 for acute psychosis that he discovered was in fact a spiritual experience. Author of the book, Am I Bipolar or Waking Up? And the YouTube channel, Bipolar or Waking Up? Sean is the facilitator of breathwork healing retreats for people diagnosed with bipolar disorder and psychosis. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio host is Will Hall. Producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio is an affiliate of Madden America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at maddenamerica.com.